Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, I'm Ethan Suplee. Welcome to American Glutton. Outside of acting, my two favorite things to do are diet and eat. I have a very complicated relationship with food, and on this podcast, we're going to talk about all of it. Food as entertainment, food as sport, food as fuel. I'll talk to experts and the average person, just like you and me. I'm trying right now to talk more about this coronavirus crisis because I think it's for sure the biggest test that many of us will ever face. I mean, what better time than to sit at home with a pint of ice cream and a pizza that will arrive piping hot in 30 seconds or less? We can beat this thing, the forced sedentary state, the fear-induced eating, and the apathy. We can beat it by paying attention to guys like Mike Isratel. Mike's company, Renaissance Periodization, has been delivering his powerful ideas to people's phones for years. I cannot recommend them enough, especially at a time when we have such great limitations. Today, I get to talk to Dr. Mike Isratel. Mike has a PhD in sports physiology. He's the chief sports scientist at Renaissance Periodization and is a former professor of exercise and sports science. I just want to say that Mike's TED Talk, The Scientific Landscape of Healthy Eating, is awesome. And I mean, it has changed the way I look at food. You can find Mike on Instagram at rpdrmike. That's at rpdrmike. I just want to warn you ahead of time that Mike and I are pirates, and we speak as such. If you have an adverse reaction to foul language, this might not be the episode for you. Dr. Isratel.
I don't know anyone by that name.
God damn it! They gave me the wrong fucking number, man. I knew it. Is it
What's
you?
Up?
It is you. It is clearly you. I know this voice.
It is clearly me.
I really want to start out by saying thank you. You made a big change in my life. I don't know, knowingly or unknowingly, I had done keto for a long time and lost weight and was thinking I was successful, but I was having this issue that I kept looking in the mirror and seeing my body look pretty much the same, just smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And I started down this kind of hole of like searching out what the problem was. And I came across your TED Talk, The Scientific Landscape of Healthy Eating.
I like that you went straight to YouTube for your, you know, biggest problems. You're like, there's got to be a video about this.
Yeah. Well, Google led me to you. I typed in, I'm not retaining enough muscle on keto. Where do I go? And Google said, watch this YouTube video.
Oh, man.
And it was you. You know, having grown up in Los Angeles, I've been the effect of every health craze that has ever existed in the last 40 years.
And, oh, yeah.
And, you know, it goes from this type of vegetable is bad, this type of fat is bad, too much salt is bad, too much sugar is bad. And watching your video, it kind of just chilled me out and was like, you know, I know there are certain people with actual allergies that can have reactions to stuff like gluten. And you know, I have a kid who was blood tested and told she has an allergy to eggs, so she doesn't eat eggs. But kind of outside of that, we're buying these magic ideas or ideas that are magic pills or magic bullets or whatever you want to call them to kind of like put all the onus of blame on one thing or one category or one food group so that if we just get that out of our life, we'll be okay. And
yeah,
you basically dispelled me of that.
Well, I'd say it's my pleasure. I suppose I didn't intend on doing that, but I guess I did, because hopefully, you know, the reason I did that talk was to change some minds, and I'm really glad that it had a positive effect for you, man. I will say that a lot of the YouTube commentators have had different impressions of the video, like I'm a shill for big vegan, or a shill for carnivore, or a shill for big dairy, or just a shill in general. My God.
Right. And I couldn't have taken more of an opposing viewpoint on what you said, because you seem to be a shill for nothing.
Yeah. Big science.
You seem to be advocating. Yeah. But there was no, like, you didn't present it in a way of, the only thing you said is as long as 10%. The only thing that I took away, which was like the fundamental of this, is you got to get at least 10% of your calories from these three things.
Mm-hmm.
And outside of that, you've pretty much got room to dance around. And even on, you know, even on keto, I think they're allowing up to 10% in carbs.
Yep, absolutely. You can stay in ketosis with up to 10% carbs. And honestly, like, if you had to cut your carbs much lower than that, like, good God, like, a bunch of foods, like nuts would be out, you know, like keto would be miserable. You might as well go carnivore at that point.
Right. So I watched that, and then I got your book, your diet book, which I think is fantastic. I think I at first also was like, well, I'm going from high fat to low fat, and went to basically no fat,
mm-hmm.
Other than the scant amount in a boneless, skinless chicken breast. And so didn't feel well, and then started supplementing with fish oil, and then started going like, I'm being too strict on this, actually. A little bit of fat is okay. And have found this zone where I continue to lose weight, albeit slowly, but I'm not losing muscle. And I actually see a difference in my body, which is kind of what I was waiting to see while going to the gym and doing keto.
So you were weight training and doing keto at the same time.
Yeah. And my energy has been a lot better doing this low fat diet, just counting macros. I've been able to stay in the gym longer. I've been able to do more in the gym. Another thing I want to ask you about is progressive overload on a cut. Maybe you could talk about progressive overload for anyone who doesn't understand the concept of that.
Sure. Would you like me to start now?
Yes, please.
So essentially, progressive overload and training comes down to the fact that your body tends to adapt to any training you give it after long enough of a time. But once your body adapts to that training, it doesn't really respond anymore. Your gains from any given session start to just become unimpressive. So the way to challenge that, or the way to solve that problem fundamentally, is to present an ever more difficult challenge to your body. And that's the progressive component of overload. So training has to be two things. One, it has to be hard. Like, it fundamentally has to challenge you. If you're training and you're like, man, these are super easy workouts, and you're probably not growing any muscle, right? Almost certainly not. And then, so training has to be tough to begin with. And for the progression component, because your body adapts over time, the training has to get tougher over time, just by a little bit, tougher and tougher and tougher and tougher. Now, when you look at that in the context of a fat loss diet, you have this huge missing element, which is enough calories to really recover and adapt to your fullest potential. And as a matter of fact, when you subtract those calories, which you have to do in order to lose fat, especially lots of fat, you end up really reducing the ability of adaptation you can go through. So what that means is that maybe you used to put 5 pounds on the bar every other week and get the same reps back when you were gaining weight or maintaining it. You were getting stronger pretty fast. You were getting more muscular, so on and so forth. On a fat loss plan, the number one thing you want to make sure to do is try your best not to regress. So even if you can't add any weight to the bar and your reps are roughly the same week to week to week, after 3 months of a fat loss phase, if you're about the same strength as you were, that very likely means you didn't lose any muscle. And because you lost a bunch of weight, that means almost everything was fat. That's wonderful. Then if you do a maintenance phase or even a slow massing phase where you gain a little bit of weight, you can get new strength. Your body's super sensitive to getting stronger. You make gains, you make gains, you make gains. And then when it's time to do your next fat loss phase again, you sort of continue to try to make gains, but you accept the idea that there might not be a whole lot of gains to go around. And actually, one of the ways in which this happens, it's super simple. You use which is basically called reps in reserve method, or you could also call those related concepts as RP, rating of perceived exertion. Basically, if you are within 3 reps shy of muscular failure, like unable to get another good rep with good technique, you're doing a real good job at stimulating muscle growth. So what you want to do is make sure your sets on average in a couple months phase of muscle growth training, you want to make sure that they're like around 2 reps in reserve. Like you can totally go to failure all the time if you want, that's just fine. You can go as far as 3 reps from failure and you get really great results, just fine. So let's say an average of 2. Let's say we just keep it super simple example and say 2 reps from failure is what I want. So, and let's say you're doing sets of 10 in the leg press, super, super simple example. And it doesn't really get much more complicated than this. Week one, you do 300 pounds for sets of 10. No problem, about 2 reps left in the tank on each one of those sets. Great. Week two, you know, you probably got stronger and you might have gained a little bit of muscle, and especially you got stronger nervous system wise. So if you do 300 pounds and your goal is to hit sets of 10 at 2 reps in reserve, you might get there and you hit sets of 12 with 2 reps in reserve. You're like, gee, you know, okay, well, my goal is sets of 10. I better get the weight up on this exercise next time. So you come back and you add 10 pounds, you say 310 pounds. Then you again hit sets of 12, again at 2 reps in reserve. And like, oh my God, I'm getting so strong. I'm not even able to go back to sets of 10. I'm going to go to 330 pounds next week. And then you go to 330, 2 reps in reserve, all the sets of 10. Awesome. So as your body gets stronger, you feed it more weight or more reps in order to challenge it the same way again, in order to get it close to 2 reps from failure again, which means it's a super, super challenge. So the challenge, the overload, is from how close to failure you get. The progression is how much weight or reps you need to do in order to get there. It's a self-solving problem because when you're gaining weight or when you're maintaining weight, your body gets stronger week to week to week, or doesn't get, you know, weaker as easily, and you can add more weight and more reps, because basically if you don't, you'll just start getting crazy reps or you're getting really, really far away from failure and your sets will be too easy. But when you're in a fat loss phase, you know, you come in that next day, the next week, and you're like, okay, I did 300 pounds of leg press last time for sets of 10, 2 reps in reserve, but gee, you know, I'm really struggling. It's just not a lot of calories. Let's try 305 pounds. And you get it for sets of 10, but like 1 rep in reserve. Like, holy crap, that was hard. Next week, I know I'm not going to make a huge adaptation. So I'm going to try 305 pounds again, see if I can get sets of 10 again, but maybe 2 reps in reserve. You try it, it works, awesome. Repeat that for a couple of weeks. So now in a fat loss phase, you might have gone from 300 for sets of 10 in the leg press in the first week. And then the week before you deload, let's say in week 5, before you take a little break, you might be at 315 pounds for sets of 10, right? But if you were in a muscle gain phase, like you were gaining weight, you might have gone from 300 to 340 in the same amount of time. So just by adjusting to training hard every single session and adding enough weight to the bar or enough reps to meet those challenges, your body's going to tell you how much is too much, how much is not enough.
Amazing. And just so that I understand, and anybody who is listening, can we talk about failure when you say reps in reserve would be you've done every good rep you can and you can't do another one? But does that mean like you get it down and you cannot push it up, or what is failure?
Failure is when you have all these big dreams for yourself, but you just never amount to anything.
Yes. So that's me in the gym every day.
My life. That's me in my life every day. So, okay, on a serious note, failure. There's a good way to define failure and a bad way to define failure. The which one you want first, the good way or the bad way?
Well, I want to just paint a picture for you. I tend to use the bench press on my own. So I am very careful that I'm never going to failure.
Sure.
I want it to be hard. I want it to be heavy, but because I'm there alone and I don't want to be that guy in the gym who can't get the bar up, I'm never going to failure. Every now and again, I will have that last rep get hinky and not be perfect form. And there I think I'm at failure, though I can get it up. Is that true?
Yeah. So more or less. So basically, in scientific literature, we actually use two almost identical concepts, but they're super, super nitpicky. One is zero reps in reserve, and that's what you're talking about. Zero reps in a reserve means you cannot do another single good repetition by yourself.
Right.
So when you're, you know, that lockout on the bench you're talking about, where you rack it and you're like, whoo, thank God I racked it then, because I would have been dead if I tried another one.
Yeah.
That's zero reps in reserve. Now, that's not technically failure, because failure means you need to try to get it up and it doesn't work halfway or some way through the movement, it falls back on you.
Okay.
The difference between failure and zero reps in reserve, as far as the muscles and them growing and adding fatigue, is basically nothing, right? It's like a half or quarter rep away. It's not a big deal. But for safety, it's a big deal. And especially if you're bench pressing or squatting by yourself, gee, man, even zero reps in reserve is a little bit of playing with fire. One rep in reserve accomplishes tons of really great growth, especially in those compound movements, but doesn't require you to, like, you know, sort of thank God after that rep that you didn't just shit the bed and then, you know, it's all downhill.
Right. And since the whole idea is being able to do something like this multiple times a week or even every day, maybe not the same movements, but the whole point is that you're doing something and you're going to do it better the next day. The way you're talking about this, if it's just as beneficial, it also sounds a hell of a lot safer than going to the point of failure.
Totally. There is one caveat, which is people who are not used to training, beginners, are really pretty bad at estimating how far from failure they are. There was at least one sort of seminal study that was done in which some people, these are legit human beings, they tested in the lab. When they asked them to say to the researcher while they were lifting that, hey, I have like two reps left, they started counting how many reps left, and the researcher started yelling them, motivating them, and everyone was there to spot, ready to take the bar from them when they failed. At least a few people got 10 more reps after that.
Oh, like, wow.
That's crazy, right? And those people should just be shamed right out of any gym. I'm just kidding. But, you know, with beginners, the good news is they don't have to even get remotely close to failure to see great results. For intermediate folks, advanced folks, folks like yourself that have been lifting for a while, I think it's important to occasionally reach true failure on safe exercises where it's all right, just to make sure you're not, is it okay if I swear a little bit?
Please, all you want.
I thought this was a family podcast. I can't even blame them on.
Yes, but it's a family of pirates.
Excellent. So, you know, every now and again, as an intermediate lifter, and especially as advanced, you should be going to failure on occasion so that you know you're not shitting yourself, right? Like, you could be like, oh man, I'm training two reps in reserve. And then a training partner comes in that you never see and they train with you. And all of a sudden you're like doubling your reps. You're like, man, I was fucking lying to myself because apparently I was just not training as hard as I thought. So yes, ideally, it's good to train with an average of two reps in reserve, sometimes less, sometimes more. But I think everyone should, over the beginner stage, intermediates and advanced, should relatively regularly approach true failure just to make sure that they're on the right track.
Right. And having that idea that if you're new to weight training and it can be hard to gauge, like, but, you know, I certainly didn't go into a gym knowing what I could do. Is there any suggestion you have for people? Should they be going to failure just to know what they can do?
Definitely not beginners. And here's why. Beginners don't have a very good technical base established yet. Their technique on the lifts, for lack of a better term, sucks. And if it doesn't suck, even if it's decent, it's been shown that when beginners try really hard, their technique starts to break down. You've seen that shit before, like the survival bench press where you're humping the air at the same time and your legs are dancing around. Like, I don't even sure what that is anymore. So you don't want beginners to try that hard that their technique breaks down. It's slight risk of injury. And also, they're probably going to be learning crappy technique at that point. So it's nothing you want to encourage. What I would encourage beginners to do is, number one, focus on technical mastery. Like, you want to be the person in the gym doing really good technique on exercises, controlled, full range of motion. You got a plan for where the bar is going to go. It doesn't just go willy-nilly. There's no ego. That's number one, because that's going to get you, first of all, great results. And second of all, build a really, really good base for when you're more advanced, stronger. And if you have really bad technique when you're stronger, you're really putting yourself at a high risk of injury then. So technique's number one for beginners. And then the cool thing is, beginners adapt so fast, right? They may gain so fast. Just make sure as a beginner that when the training feels pretty easy, add more reps, add more weight, or do more sets or constrain your rest times, make it harder. And if you just follow that road to slightly harder and slightly harder and slightly harder, eventually two things are going to happen. One, you're going to be training pretty hard. And two, you're going to be an intermediate and you're going to know way more about your body and you're not going to be confused about what's hard and what's not. Like, what you don't want is someone benches 100 pounds on their first day of training for set of 10. And then a year later are still benching 100 pounds for sets of 10. And they're like, well, you know, it's so much easier now. Like, you know, people ask, I'm sure people have asked you this, like, well, the training, it gets easier as you do it, right? Like over the months, you're like, no, it gets harder and, or at least stays just as hard, but now I can do more. Right. You know what I mean? So you got to just keep that mind, keep that thought in people's heads of like, you are in the gym to challenge yourself. As long as you feel you're being challenged, good to go. And that means you should regularly, not all the time, be adding weight and reps to the bar, maybe a few sets, maybe constraining rest times. If you get to the gym at any point, you're like, man, these workouts are easy. Gee, you know, maybe you mistook what a gym is for. The gym is for challenge. If you're not being challenged, you could be at home rolling blunts or whatever you derelicts do in California.
Not me, but yes, that's what they do. and they go and they roll blunts and then they pop sliced turkey in their mouth as they're munchy.
Excellent.
In the parking lot of the gym, and they're all swigging on protein shakes. I think that's really wise. When I used to ride bicycles, they would say it never gets easier, you just go faster. And I think that's basically the same principle.
Exactly the same thing.
Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. I have so many periods of my life that I have in mind. There was a point in time where I was eating whatever I wanted. I weighed 150 pounds more than I weighed.
The good life.
Yeah. And I was lifting weights every day. I just didn't care about anything. And I was a lot stronger than I am now. But I do truly regret that I didn't start the diet I'm on now at that weight, because I would be bigger than Arnold Schwarzenegger had I just lost fat from that point. So I do miss those whatever, however many pounds of muscle I killed off. Will you talk a little bit about muscle for fat loss? I go back and forth about thinking how to talk about this, because ultimately I think, you know, this is not a show about bodybuilding. This is more a show about weight loss. However, I do know that muscle uses calories, but I'm loath kind of to say like, you can eat more, you know what I mean? Because maybe the whole point is that we're supposed to be just more super responsible for what we eat. But I also think that the idea of retaining muscle, it makes your body function more than the idea of consuming all the muscle that you have. And I just want to get a more sciencey perspective on that.
Sure. Well, the good news is a sciencey perspective is actually rather straightforward. Added muscle, you know, per pound or whatever of muscle versus fat, it burns like a very small number of extra calories. So you'll be able to eat more if you're more muscular instead of just skinny. Like, it's true as far as it goes, but it just doesn't nearly go far enough to make any relevant point. Like, you barely notice the calories.
Okay, good.
However, muscle has a couple of really, really awesome advantages. First of all, if you have lots of muscle on your body, it essentially works like a glucose sponge. Muscle is anti-diabetic.
Oh, wow.
Like, if you're really jacked, it just eats a bunch of stuff that comes into the bloodstream and you end up being metabolically healthier. Like, I have like chronic hypoglycemia all the time, more or less, if I don't eat consistently, because I have very large muscles and they just eat whatever the hell comes into my body.
Right.
So that's a really, really super good thing, especially for folks who have had a history of being over fat and overweight, and their, you know, glucose sensitivity is not amazing, and so on and so forth, right? Gaining muscle is a really, really awesome thing for those folks. Second point is, if you have gained muscle, your functioning ability is like 50 times better, right? You're actually strong, you're fast, you're endurant. You can do regular stuff, like no number of grocery bags is too many for you. And especially, you know, as folks get older, if you continue to have a high level of muscle mass for your age, you just straight up don't see the kind of decrements in age with performance and moving around that other people do. Like, if you're stronger than you were in your 20s, when you were in your 50s, which is totally possible, by the way, you'll straight up feel, for all intents and purposes, moving around day to day, just about as good as you did when you were in your 20s. And a lot of people, once they hit their 30s, 40s, 50s, they think, oh man, you know, that typical, I don't want to call it an excuse. Sometimes it is like, oh, I'm not in my 20s anymore. Like, yeah, you sure as hell aren't. So looking at your body, could have told you that, right? But if you have muscle, then like, you know, then it's your ability to function is super awesome. I trained in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, And he used to train against a guy who was a former bodybuilder, and he still lifted super jacked, and he was in his 60s. He would whoop my ass up and down the mat, and he had a fucking man strength. I was like, what the heck? How, you're 6 years old. How's this happening? And I was a competitive powerlifter at the time. And he had just so much technique and so much strength. I was like, okay, you're old on paper, but you're really not old. And, he had a good laugh at that, but that was the case. And then lastly, and this is like super pertinent to the California crowd, is if you gain muscle while you're losing fat, or do some combination of both, or even if you lose sort of a lot of weight first and then you regain muscle, the end point appearance of that, if you have muscle, is so, I don't want to value judge, right? I'm not remotely into skinny women, for example. Like, my wife is thicker than hell. I love it, right? But like, you can look skinny and it's totally cool. It's totally fine. But most people like some substance, right? Like, it's the difference between being lean. Like, ooh, here's a good example. Jessica Biel, circa Blade Trinity. Tell me you remember that amazing movie.
Yeah.
50 Oscars. It won Oscars for 2 years straight. No one had ever done that before. So, like, they postponed half the Oscars. So Jessica Biel, like, she's got delts. She's got biceps. Like, she's not a grotesque muscle monster, even by Hollywood standards, but she's stacked up. She looks great. She feels great, so on and so forth. She has shape, right? Whereas if you just lose a bunch of weight and you don't gain any muscle, you end up looking like, people aren't really sure if you had a health transformation, or maybe you're into the heroin again, or maybe you're like, are you sick? People can't tell. So a huge benefit of muscle is that it gives you shape. And generally speaking, for males and females, muscle only goes into the places that give you really awesome shape. It's not for everyone, but like, probably 90% of people like someone with some shape to them. So as you lose weight, if you gain muscle or do it after, you end up having all these benefits of better metabolism, better glucose clearance, more ability to function in everyday life, and you probably look better too.
I will say, having gone from my highest weight to my lowest weight, where I was about 50 pounds lighter than I am now, I was really not happy with how I looked. And, I wasn't comfortable. And I actually, for the first time in a long time, and while I still look at myself with my shirt off and am critical of lots of stuff, it's little stuff. I can recognize the hard work I've put in, and I can pat myself on the back for it. And I'm much happier and more confident with my size now than I was when I just was going like, crush myself in an extreme caloric deficit to get as thin as possible. Yeah. I agree, but that's completely subjective to me. But I also think people did think I was sick, and I look at myself and I looked sickly, and my skin, there's also that thing, like, I wouldn't put this on everyone who's overweight, who has to lose weight, but when you're really big, your skin stretches out. It then grows to this new baseline so that it can still be elastic, and it doesn't really shrink, it, as far as I know. So having some muscle in there to fill that out is also super helpful.
It's a really good aesthetic look. Once you fill out the skin and you have some muscle, it just makes everything look better. And you're probably right. It's that much more of a better look for folks that have the extra skin. Because like, if you don't have extra skin and you're skinny, congratulations, like, you look Hollywood thin, sweet. But like, if you have the extra skin and then you fill it out with muscle, it's way, way, way more pleasing of a look for most people. Now, some people might not care. Some people might think otherwise. But take that for what it is. One really quick thing I did want to mention about the benefits of muscle gain that I didn't is it's been shown that a higher percentage of very overweight people tend to have more of their muscle fibers as faster twitch fibers.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the kinds of fibers that have two features. One, they are not very good at endurance activity, which, plus being heavy, like, when a person tries to lose weight, what's like the number one thing people do? Like, lose weight, cardio, treadmill. They show up super overweight to a gym and sweat in a bunch of sweats and look at each other super weird.
Right.
People who are more likely to be overweight, because they have the faster fibers, they're going to suck at cardio. Like, faster fibers accumulate lactic acid really fast, which is, cardio just burns more, and they don't adapt very well to endurance training. So it's just, cardio is always going to suck. On the other hand, they get strong fast. They get really strong and they get really big. So they respond incredibly well to resistance training. So if you are, quite a bit over fat, relatively over fat, whatever, there's probably a better chance that if you do weight training, first of all, it'll be something you like because you'll be getting better at it all the time. You know, like it sucks to do something that you suck at. Can you imagine being like, yep, I do cardio all the time. That's it. I hate it. I suck at it, but I miserable. Still do it because I don't want to be fat, right? Cardio sucks. But if you are a slower twitch individual, you'll like cardio. Like, I don't know if you've ever been in the zone for running. Like, I straight up never found that zone. I used to do cardio all the fucking time. I don't even know what the zone is. I feel like shit. It feels like shit when you start. It feels like shit in the middle. It feels like shit at the end. Why am I doing this? So if you're over fat and, you know, like considerably overweight, picking up resistance training, it may be in addition to some cardio. It'll give you great cardio benefit if you lift weights, you know, lift weights faster, so to speak, you know, keep up a good pace, do plenty of reps, but also you'll add muscle because you're probably genetically prone to add muscle. Like in your case, you for sure are because you're fucking jacked, right? And then you'll also just be getting better at this thing that you don't suck at, that you can learn to like. It can be a part of your life because a huge factor in weight loss is like, hey, a lot of people can lose weight, man. A lot of people actually do. I mean, I'm sure you've seen Biggest Loser. Like they just starve the fuck out of you and you lose the weight. It's the keeping the weight off and putting the activity and the new diet into a sustainable lifestyle. It's really, really, really tough. And for people who are doing resistance training and they're faster twitch dominant, they can learn to like it a lot. They can learn to progress with it. And then they just never quit, because why the fuck would you quit something you're good at and that you really like and it makes you awesome and it makes you healthier? Same thing for you finding the diet that works best for you. You also want to do that with diet, where you want to find a diet for people that they don't fucking hate and they can learn to live with, and then they're smooth sailing. But it's that, and that's a big problem. I'm going to stop myself in just a second because I'm getting too ranty, but a big problem with like the Hollywood type of fad bullshit is that everyone's got an answer for what's going to lose weight for the next 3 to 6 months. Sure, fucking three cheers, tap yourself on the back. But like, who's got an answer for how to sustain that for a long time and enjoy it? Those are few and far between.
Yeah, you made so many good points. I love the rant. And I would I'm sitting here like just with a huge smile on my face going, yes, yes, say more. But I want to say to your point about, for me, I wasn't bad at cardio. I've never been able to run at a time in my life where I could do a full marathon on an erg rowing machine, ride my bike 150 miles in a day. I went and ran a 5K and like had swollen knees and ankles for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I can't run, but I was okay at riding a bike. I wasn't the fastest guy, but I could get on a bike and ride it for 8 hours, no problem. The same feeling that I got riding a bike for 8 hours, I can get in a gym in 45 minutes lifting weights. And so the cost of that, as far as time goes, is just, it's incomparable. You know what I mean? And I also wind up with a body I'm more comfortable with, ultimately happier at the end of it, because I have time to hang out with my wife and kids. I don't wake up before them, get on my bike, and then show up for dinner, which I then don't eat because I'm trying to be as thin as possible. So for me, it's just a better lifestyle altogether. Days that I have a rest day, like Sunday, it's my least favorite day of the week. I never get that feeling. I kind of have to force myself to rest. I never get that good feeling that the gym gives me, but I recognize the value of that. But I think that ultimately people finding their own diets, and as far as Hollywood goes, I think the big problem with this thing where somebody tries to say everybody's problem is carbohydrates. Obviously, some people have a problem. You know, type 1 diabetics do have a problem with carbohydrates if they don't get insulin. Like, that's a real medical issue. But to kind of attach that to everyone, the disservice, beyond the fact that it's not sustainable, perhaps, for everyone for all time, is that if it's not the right diet for you and you failed at the only thing there is, or that's been sold to you as the only thing there is, what do you do next? You know, you're left with no alternative. Well, everyone is suffering from X. And if you can't figure out getting your shit together doing this thing that handles X, then it's hopeless.
There's actually, that's a really good point. There's actually something I've talked about in various lectures that is a compounding of that problem, is when you have, and this is one of the reasons why I'm so against fad diets, even though, you know, some people say like, oh, it's okay. They got people involved and they got them losing weight, right? That's a good thing. Yeah, I hear that, but fad diets, because they're unsustainable, sort of automatically self-extinguish after a while. People fall off the wagon, so on and so forth. What ends up happening is that thing you just described, where someone fails at a diet and feels like, okay, I can't succeed at this. We could say, well, there could be a solution. Just try another fad diet. But there's a real big problem with that compounding effect. And I've met real people like this. There's millions of them, where they'll do a fad diet. They won't get results, or they will, but then they'll regain the weight because they couldn't sustain it. Then they'll go to the next fad diet and the next and the next. How many diets do you have to do as a human being on average until just your logical part of your brain is best guess is like, you know, diets just aren't for us because nothing fucking works.
Right.
But like, if it's all garbage in, it's all going to be garbage out. It's like trying to download the wrong file size on your computer in a bunch of different ways, but it's all the wrong file size. You're going to be like, this clearly just doesn't work. And then someone's finally like, watch this. Here's the right file size. It downloads perfectly. You're like, huh. Okay, I didn't know that. I was ready to quit. Well, of course you're ready to quit. You're doing all these things that are fucking wrong. So fad diets are really unfortunate in the way that they set people up for failure. And, you know, a lot of people can, like, one fad diet, they can fail and be like, oh, I suck. And then some new fucking weird, like, you know, dildo diet comes out where you just eat dildo-shaped things, which is my preferred diet anyway. Right. But, you know, and they're like, oh, my God, that's for me. And they try it, and then they fail at that one. And then they fail at the other one. And then they fail at the next one. After, man, I don't know, what do you think, 3 or 4 of those attempts? A lot of people legit give up on trying to diet because, like, yeah, I'm just not going to be. And oftentimes they use the same word, like, I'm just not going to be thin, which is already like a sort of a prejudice against like being like a healthy, normal body weight and lifting weights. Like, I can't tell you how many times I've heard that. Like, well, just, I'm just a bigger person. And you're like, yeah, that might be true, but maybe not 330 pounds bigger. Maybe you're a 220 pounds bigger kind of person. So it sucks.
Right. And ultimately that's the thing is like, well, it's two things. As big as you consume to be, and as big as you perform to be, like, at the end of the day, you know, and I think there are a lot of factors out there, especially in America, that people aren't really confronting or even aware of, like the availability and the accessibility of cheap calories that you kind of can't walk out your front door without being advertised about or literally bump into on the street, and our propensity to want to consume right away when we feel hunger rather than what it was programmed. Somebody said recently to me, like, the timing of hunger is we haven't evolved out of the fact that when we're hungry, it's a signal to go and find food. But when that developed, going and finding food could have taken a whole day.
It literally meant exercise.
Right. So the thing now is like, I'm hungry and down the street there's $2,000 calories for $2, and I'm just going to do that and I'm going to drive my car there versus I'm hungry. Oh, I actually have to go work and look around and hunt and like find berry trees that are up on a cliff somewhere.
For sure.
So I don't think that a lot of the landscape of the way food is presented to us here and in most Western cultures is being taken into account. But at the same time, like, if you look at a diet and the diet makes everybody the same, that diet can't be right, because the last question I would want to ask you to benefit me is, how many calories do you eat a day? That doesn't benefit me. It's maybe, I don't know what I do with that information other than judge you.
People ask me that all the time, hilariously, and you're completely right. It's pointless.
Right. If you're going to eat however many calories I eat, are you going to also do the same exercise as me? Is your body the same weight and composition as mine? Like, there's a lot of factors into that. So
yep.
When a new diet hits Los Angeles, like, there was a diet a few years ago called HCG. Have you heard of this diet?
Oh, absolutely. Of course.
Where it's like everybody's, if you go on the diet, you're eating 500 calories a day, roughly, maybe it's 600. Everybody eats the same, and you take a dose of some hormone that is supposed to like increase testosterone so that when you're in this severe caloric deficit, you're not burning muscle, which is total bullshit. Like, if you're that deep in a caloric deficit, you're killing muscle.
And, oh, God, yeah.
and then everybody's just eating the same thing. Like, if I do that diet, my buddy Kevin Connolly, who weighs probably less than half what I weigh or around half what I weigh, he does that diet. It just can't. It's just not rational that we would be consuming the same thing in order to get, you know what I mean?
Yeah. People want a very simple one size fits all solution. And they can probably have pretty close to it if they do a little bit of thinking. But a lot of folks are not interested so much in thinking, but more in feeling. And there's a tendency, especially in certain circles, to just kind of do what's hot. You know, what's the thing right now? And in many fields that are very serious, in which results are expected, that kind of thinking straight up is either laughed out of the room or you get your license taken away or it doesn't occur. For example, can you imagine going to med school and being like, yeah, I'm just here to learn like what the trends are, like what's hot? Like, shut up, idiot. Here's 150 years of physiology before your dumbass asks any more questions. You're like, fuck, I have to learn actual shit. Right? Electrical engineering. You're like, what's the latest? Like, well, how does the circuit work? You're like, I don't know. Like, what the fuck are you? You won't even be able to contextualize what the latest is. The latest is 150 years of electrical engineering. Like, here's, you got to learn it. But when people come to diets, you know, they're like, hey, what's the latest? And someone's like, here it is. It's just a simple thing. You don't have to learn any basics. And are you likely to reach a correct answer? You know, in medicine, yes. In electrical engineering, yes. In dieting, no, because you're just shooting in the dark. So I think people absolutely were, you're 100% right. We're in an, what's called an obesogenic environment. We have incredibly high standard of living, which means we have a lot of money to spend. Food as a, is related to how much income we have on average, progressively gets cheaper every decade. And, you know, it's food companies' job to make foods as tasty as possible so that you buy more of them. Like, it's literally their job, and it's not nefarious. There's no mystery about it. Like, they're just trying, it's like saying Hollywood's making movies that are too fucking good and we're spending too much time watching movies. No fucking shit. That's what they're supposed to be doing, right? So food companies want you to eat more of their tasty food. And if you are going to go and just buy whatever they sell and just use food sort of like a, I don't want to say drug, but you know, like you're essentially getting high off of it, then it's going to lead down a road that's not going to be excellent for you. So I think at some point, some personal responsibility, kind of like what you did, I don't want to put you on the spot, fucking Mr. Hero over here, right? But you fucking woke up and you're like, you know what? I want to fucking learn some shit because something's not working for my body. And then you also know, I mean, look, like you're in the same obesogenic environment we all are, except for some fucking weird, mysterious reason. You don't just like eat Skittles every fucking hour or eat, you know, go to the taco cart down the street and just like tip the whole thing over and eat the fucking guy making the tacos and all the taco materials. Like somehow you're able to resist. And I think that figuring out how people can have patterns of behavior which are good for them and support a healthy lifestyle is probably a real productive conversation to have, at least for a lot of people, versus being like, well, you know, it's this obesogenic environment. Like, yeah, totally. But that shit's not going anywhere. I mean, unless people plan on making, you know, tasty food illegal, I don't want to live in that fucking world. Fuck that.
Yeah. There was a lot of years, though, that I went kind of white knuckling my way through it, not even aware of this obesogenic diet, which I've not heard those words before, but they're fantastic. And I probably will steal them from you and just be saying them constantly from now on because it's so exactly what it is. But there was a moment, and, you know, I don't know why this is, but the idea of being red-pilled has a political connotation because the other pill is blue. Although it comes from a movie, The Matrix, and it has nothing to do with politics. So I like the analogy or the metaphor of being red-pilled, where it's like, here's a pill that you take and you just continue through life as it is. And here's a pill you take and you kind of see things differently. It just kind of shifts your perspective. And so after having spent a lot of time just kind of going like, everyone is normal, I'm abnormal, I don't know what it was. And I think it was through education and really reading a lot about food and how the body uses food and all of that kind of stuff, where I started looking around going, no, this is all being done in a way that is, if I don't recognize that it's being done this way, then I am effect of it. Then I can't help but buy into the way that McDonald's advertises and
100%.
You know, but if I'm aware of like, here's what my body is genetically programmed to do, Here's how it reacts to food. Here's how my body thinks about food. Here's how food is being presented to me, which is completely at odds with my goals for my body. The recognition of that really is a moment where you go, oh, I don't have to play that game.
Yeah. And I'll tell you this, you don't have to hate that game either, because you know your path and you could just stick to it and be okay with other paths. Like, for example, a lot of people, when they switch to eating much more healthy and they have their maybe like mini red pill moment, a lot of them are like, man, yeah, fast food sucks and junk food's terrible and it's bad. And they start to moralize. That's totally fine. But I think maybe after they give it some more time and feel things through, a more sustainable, maybe more rational approach is being like, you know, like someone asked me like, hey, Dr. Mike, what do you think about McDonald's? I mean, like, you know, I think it provides relatively cheap, very tasty food that you can have on occasion. But if you have a lot of it sort of all the time, you gain a lot of weight, you become rather unhealthy, and you're going to not like your life. And none of that's like McDonald's is bad, right? But if someone's like, hey, are you going to eat McDonald's for your next meal? You could be like, you know, I'm not. I'm going to eat like chicken breast and brown rice and some veggies and fruits because that supports my goals and my direction. And they're like, okay, so McDonald's is bad. You're like, it's not bad. It's just like not for me at the time. I'll go on a limb here real quick and make another analogy that's just, you know, of course, predictably stupid for me to make on a radio show. Like, is there anything so wrong with going and like having sex with people consensually? No, sex is beautiful. It's totally fine, right? But like, if you're on your way to work, you're supposed to be going to work and you're like, fuck, I need to get laid. And you hit up a person that you're like, fuck buddy or whatever. And you're like, let's just bang for 8 hours. Like, can someone say like, no, you need to reevaluate your life. Sex is bad. Like, no, that's fucking bullshit. It's not bad. But like, there's a time and a place for the shit, and a time and a place for McDonald's junk food may in your life be almost never. It could be very rarely. It could be on occasion, or it could be often, so long as it's meeting the goals you set out for yourself. Like, if food, there's not just this concept of like food, just food, and you eat food and then you don't. Like, there's different kinds of foods, and some of the foods are more sustainable for health, longevity, so on and so forth, and they don't make you rebound hungry and super crazy if you eat just a little bit. And those are the foods that you probably mostly should eat. And then junk food and stuff like that's not bad. It's just not the right tool for the job most of the time. I don't know if any of that made sense.
Oh, 100%. Yes, 100%. And I would never put, I mean, food, there is no moral in food. It's a thing. And a business whose job is to sell a food is doing their job by selling me the food. I don't think there's any immorality in the way it's being done. I actually think it's like that we as a society demanded it, and that we got what we demanded. And there are kind 100%. Of, yeah, there's some unintended consequences that people haven't, I hadn't ever recognized. I just had never kind of understood, like, I'm hungry, I'm going to eat. Now, my parents or my grandparents are withholding food, so now I'm going to create the habit of sneaking food, which then followed me through life. And it led me to even sneaking fast food. And I wouldn't go into the store. I would get it at the drive-thru so nobody would see me, and I'd eat it in my car. All of that is on me. These things are just there. But the minute I recognized it, yeah, me and my kid had never had McDonald's fries. I took her 3 days ago because I was like, oh, they're the best fries. They're fantastic French fries. We have to go try them. And we just bought a bag of fries, and we didn't even finish it. We each ate a few fries, and that was that. There was nothing immoral about that. And I find no problem morally with buying French fries from McDonald's. Sure. It was mostly my point of view, which was I was just sitting around going, I can't do anything about this. And the minute I started to become responsible for myself, my point of view shifted on it, and I was able to recognize all these things that I could only be in control of when I recognized them. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
There's actually an interesting phenomenon whereby if you make something morally forbidden, there's a sort of a rebound in not everyone, but a lot of people that makes them want it more. Like, there's a trend to wanting the forbidden. If you tell someone like, okay, fast food, junk food, you can't have it. It's terrible. It's bad. It makes you a bad person. Don't eat it. Like, a lot of people will be like, okay, and then they'll crave the fuck out of it. But like, when you tell them like that, yeah, you can have it, it's just not like super great for your goals. You're like, man, that's not the kind of, that's not very motivating, you know, like not exactly running to McDonald's because I can even have some if I want. It's just not amazing for my goals. That doesn't, you know, that's not enough temptation for me to go do anything. So like you had a couple fries and you're like, eh, McDonald's fries are good, but they're not fucking crack, you know, right. like and stop eating them. And if they're like, you're not supposed to have them and they taste way better than all the other food you're eating and you're starving yourself all the time, holy shit, that's a recipe for eating like a bunch of bags of fries.
Yeah. And I think that a lot of these fad diets work on principles similar to that, where it's
exactly
like this thing, like whatever it is, eggplant or bell peppers are, you know, a month ago, a buddy of mine was like, oh, you can't eat that. Those have lectins. Even though when I looked, everything has lectins. Everything.
What?
Everything.
Where do people get this?
Yeah. Well, no. And I've had this fight with my wife's in-laws many times, and I've actually done tests on them surreptitiously, which is probably that is immoral, but there was a big like I was with my wife's sister and we were in China and she was eating a hard-boiled egg. Now she peeled the egg and ate the egg and then was like, oh, I know it has MSG in it.
What?
And I was like, how did they get, what did they inject the egg prior to boiling it? How did they get the MSG? And she was like, nope, I know everything has MSG and now I feel a fluish. And so I did a thing where I was like, I know that MSG is in a lot of food naturally. And I know that this whole like quack nutritionist thing of MSG is evil is pretty much bullshit. And I started putting MSG in the food that I cooked for people. And nobody ever got sick. Nobody ever got a headache or anything. But it did, having being a kid and being told we don't eat Chinese food anymore because of MSG, only if they don't have MSG. Well, I was the guy who was like, I want to get a big bucket of this MSG and cut rails of it. You know, like,
yeah.
What's this MSG stuff that sounds fantastic if it makes you sick? And I think many diets do that. I really did believe that carbohydrates were the bane of my existence. For a number of years, I didn't eat them at all. And if there was a holiday where I would be begged by my family to not be super strict on my diet, and I would go, okay, I would feel like crap for the next couple of days, but I would actually now attribute that to just binge eating on those.
Yeah,
holidays.
100%.
And you know, after reading your book and going like, okay, here's the diet I'm going to set for myself. The first day of reintroducing carbohydrates into my diet was maybe one of the scariest days of my life. And
I'm sorry to have brought you so much fear through my book.
So much fear. And by the way, I gained 3 pounds that day, which just complicated the terror I felt. And then I gained 3 pounds the next day. And I was like, what the fuck am I doing? I'm undoing all of this hard work. And then I think I gained 2 pounds the day after that. So I'm up 8 pounds in 3 days. And I just kept going like, science says that my muscles are filling with fluid and that's what this way. And I had to literally talk myself through it. But this is years of having this idea that carbohydrates were making me fat. And that it had nothing to do with calories. It was just the carbohydrate itself. You know, when I got through the anxious 3 days, the weight started to come off and I wound up losing a pound in the first week.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Okay, I have two new obsessions that I need to share with you. Impress No Glue Press-On Manis and Impress Press-On Falsies Lashes. Trust me, these are getting ready game changers. Both require no glue, so there is no damage to your natural nails and lashes, no mess, and no annoying dry times. Just one step and you're done. Boom. Instant glam. Visit impressbeauty.com/presson and use code PRESSON25 at checkout for 25% off Impress manicure and Press-On falsies.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness,
because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
That was like a miraculous thing. And then, you know, over the course of 5 or 6 weeks, the 10 pounds that I lost made more of a visual difference in my body than the previous 30 had.
Wow.
It was a big deal.
That's really cool, man. I figure halfway through that carb up period, you're like, this fucking Dr. Mike is a total fucking liar.
Well, I did. You know, I had to talk myself into not giving up. It was terrifying because I just was like, am I just believing this now? What do I believe? I don't know what to believe. You know what I mean? Like, carbs are bad. Carbs are not bad the way I eat. And I think when I really go back and look at any diet that I've done that I've lost weight on, the only common theme is that I was in a calorie deficit. And so I take that and I go like, okay, if I apply it to this, how do I get enough protein? I can't get enough protein on keto. It defeats keto. So I'm going to switch over to the fuel source of carbohydrates versus fat. And in order to keep my calories down, I got to cut something way back.
The kind of folks that tend to respond best to, I don't know if it's our advertising, or whatever, just buy more of our products or whatever. We got like a diet app and all this other stuff to help people diet and train. The kind of people that we seem to get a lot of is people that have tried a bunch of fads, gone through the ringer, and just fucking tired of it. And then like back 10 years ago, before they started any fad dieting, they would look at boring-ish kind of science measured kind of, well, you know, eat healthy foods, reduce your calories, exercise. They would look at that and be like, fuck that. There's no way that that's the answer. I want the fucking Juice Cleanse 5000. It's going to get me all these results in a week. Back then, they weren't ready for that shit. Yeah. After years, they look at the boring and they're like, man, maybe that was right.
Right.
And I don't know.
You know, the first diet I did kind of my own volition with the intent of like, I'm going to change my life. I did a liquid diet, but I was 500. I wouldn't do a liquid diet today, but I was 530 plus pounds. And if I go back to that point, I go, yeah, it was completely fine for me to take off 80 pounds in 2 months at 530.
Sure.
But I had a different goal. That was like, I'm dying. I need to kickstart this somehow. You know, if I had gone into it at that point going, I'm going to lose a pound a week, it would have been a 9-year progression. Now, in fairness, I've been doing this for 18 years, so I would have beaten it in half the time had I stuck to it.
Right.
But I think there was so much kind of in the ether that there is something doing this to you. It's not you. It wasn't me. There's something that's floating around. And if you just hold on to this idea that, it's whatever it is, lectins, MSG, saturated fat, polysaturated fat, sugar, salt, carbohydrates, whole grains. You know, I did hear recently that a buddy was like, you can't eat brown rice anymore. You can only eat rice. And it's like, do you eat brown rice and not feel well? Well, then don't eat brown rice. I mean, that's about it. Did you get a test and they said you're allergic to brown rice? Outside of that, I think that looking for the causality in a thing is a mistake, that we can control it all.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, with an like evolutionary perspective, where you think like, okay, we got sort of two competing hypotheses. One is that we're just supposed to be lean, mean, fat-burning machines, and this one food ingredient or this one environmental pollutant, that's what's fucking up our physiology and making us these fat pieces of shit, right? Okay, that's hypothesis one. Hypothesis two is that, like, we evolved largely in a time when starvation was the norm and food was not plentiful, and we've evolved very distinct tastes for high sugar, high fat, and just tasty food with lots of salt and everything else in it. And that now we're so rich, thanks capitalism, that we just buy a lot of the shit we want to eat and fucking eat it because it tastes good and we eat too much and we get fat. Like, you know, one of those hypotheses is way more true than the other. You and I both know which one is more true, but man, one of them just sounds like it's got such a fucking simple, I wish that other one was true. Wouldn't it be fucking amazing, Ethan, if we could just find the fucking thing floating in the water? Like, oh, turns out fluoride for your fucking teeth is making everyone fat.
Yeah.
They just stop pumping fluoride in the water. Everyone's lean as fuck, like chiseled. Everyone's fucking Shakira and J-Lo combined, you know, they're dancing naked, saying nonsense. It's great. But like, man, that would be sweet, but that's probably just not fucking true. And the harsher truth is that, yeah, we kind of, I don't know what to say, did this to ourselves, but it's like, you know, there's some instincts here that are, you know, it's kind of like, I don't know, it's a tiny tangent, but like, it's like, why do people rob banks? You know, you could have a hypothesis like, well, you know, the social cultural forces and this fucking the Western tradition or Eastern literature of this and that, and man's unity with himself has been castrated by Western metaphysical, this and that's why people could rob banks. But I mean, how do I have another hypothesis? There's fucking money inside them and people fucking like money.
Right.
I know, it sounds fucking crazy. And then they find out that if they get guns and other people don't have them, they'll just give them that money and they can go away and have money. Right? Same idea with like tasty foods and what are called technically hyperpalatable foods, right? Foods that are really, really tasty. People fucking like eating them. And if they don't stop eating them, they eat a lot of them, they gain weight. That's basically modern obesity researchers' sort of tip of the spear summary of why we're, as a country and as a modern world, more fat than ever. And I tell you what, man, you seem to have taken to it real well and understood it and accepted it. But for the love of God, a lot of people just won't buy it. And they're still looking for the fucking fluoride in the water to cure obesity.
For the past 40 years, I've been searching for that thing, you know, and if somebody had said, I have a pill and I'm going to give you the pill and it's going to block that thing. We haven't figured out what that thing is other than like there's this one molecule that's in everything and we were going to block that molecule and you're going to be fine. But that just makes less sense to me because if I go back and think about history, the really wealthy people, not one for one, but like back when everybody was thin and tiny, the fat people were the really wealthy people.
Yep. Well,
guess what? We're all fucking wealthy now.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
The homeless people in America are wealthier materially than a lot of other countries in the world. You know, it's just a crazy state where there is no cost, basically. And I know that's extreme. There is very little cost to food in America. And then there are social programs, which provide food when you don't have that little cost. So
sure.
It is basically, there's an abundance of calories available to everyone. And it makes more sense to me that we have created this cornucopia of available calories. And we just haven't realized that like, oh, we need to be a little bit more in control of what we do with this or not care.
100%.
Yeah.
100%. Because like, you know, fundamentally, that's like maybe one of the greatest things that's ever happened. Can you imagine like talking to fucking someone and like, I don't know, we teleport like George Washington into like the podcast right now. And he's like, oh my God, what's going on? You know, shut up, talking to this mic. Listen, like ask us about how the society you helped create is. And he's like, are people starving? Or be like, nope, the poorest people are fat. They're like, he'd be like, that's fucking incredible. You guys won. We did it. Be like, well, no, it's a serious problem, sir. You just, you're clearly dated. You know, we just teleport him right the fuck back. Like, yeah, you know, it's an awesome thing that everyone in the Western world has tons of money and can buy tons of food. Now it's time, I think, and some folks are getting into this, it's maybe time to stop searching for sort of miracle cures for what's causing obesity, understand what's causing obesity, is the overeating of highly palatable foods primarily. And just at first bringing people, like bringing that to mass attention, you know, because like, man, I don't know of any a real big source of that kind of knowledge, like a documentary or a big celebrity, or well, other than you, I guess. There's just not this big push behind, like, hey, it's super tasty foods eaten in excess that makes us fat. Like, there's a guy for keto. There's tons of people for carnivore. I mean, vegans, half of Hollywood's probably fucking vegan, which is, by the way, a great way to do things. It's just not the only way. There just hasn't been that realization at a mass level of people being like, fuck, you know what? Why obesity is high is because there's tons of tasty foods and we just keep fucking buying them.
Right.
And maybe if we bought fewer of them, like, it's interesting too, to the little intellectual exercise. Imagine that the year was 1938 in the United States. I picked the fucking depression year, basically 1946. Great. Economy's booming. You have sort of plenty of money, relatively speaking, and you get the fucking munchies hard and you're at home. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? Like, grocery stores have more or less just basic items, right? Fast food's barely a thing. You got to get in your car and drive real far to go get it. Like, or even like, I don't know, the 1920s is probably a better example. Like, what are you going to do? You have to cook yourself a meal. And listen, I don't know how you cook, but I cook like fucking dog shit. I would make myself something that's so unappealing, I would eat enough of it to fuel myself and squash hunger, not cravings, which is two different concepts. Like, cravings is what you want to eat. Hunger is like when you're not hungry anymore, you're not hungry, right? Like, you get a craving for dessert even after you're full from pasta. So like, if you just eat normal, regular food that you make yourself that isn't like designed by corporations to be as tasty as possible, man, you're just probably not going to get that out of shape. It's really, you can imagine someone's like, hey, here's this boiled fucking meat and this loaf of bread. Have at it. It's your cheat day. You'd be like, fuck.
Right.
Right? But nowadays we want to fucking, you know, touch our palate a little bit. Oh my God, dude, I can get sushi delivered in a fucking 45 minutes in 5 different restaurants. Holy crap. It's a thing. And at some point you got to say, hey, maybe I can make better choices. And that's a shitty fucking red pill. It's like, you know, Morpheus gives you the red pill and you're like, all right, where are the fucking robots? He's like, nothing. Like, here's the reality is just exactly what it is. Let me explain some shit. And you're like, this pill sucks. I want the blue pill too. Dude, I would just take both pills, man. I'd be like, I'm sorry, sir. Am I to understand that you're offering me free drugs? He'd be like, yeah, I guess. Like, boom, just both pills right away. Time to get high.
Yes. That's amazing too, because you're right, because there is no evil conspiracy. Like, I go back to like the subsidization of corn and soy and beef and think it's a plot, you know, and I still believe that that plays some role in it. But the role
sure
is people were actually starving to death in America and the government went, how do we stop this? Okay, let's make sure there's enough food. And I think it just got out of control and there was no talk of like, hey, all you people who aren't starving to death, you don't need to eat at the same kind of price point. So like, if you were consuming one cheeseburger for $5, when we drop it down to $2, you don't need to consume 2.5.
For sure. Well, that's like the supersize menu at all the restaurants, right? Like, for an extra 25 cents, you can supersize it. Like,
right.
If you think it's funny too, like, so the subsidies are definitely, I mean, like, economists are pretty, as far as I'm aware, economists are pretty in unanimous sort of consensus that, you know, if you subsidize anything, you get an overconsumption of it.
Yeah.
And that's pretty straightforward. The time for food subsidies is like outdated by probably 80 years. Like, it's for sure, it doesn't need to be a thing. That being said, though, if you instantly remove all food subsidies, it's by no means clear that the price of food is going to radically go up. And the market trend, fundamentally, like, what do markets do? Advanced hyper-competitive markets like we have in the United States. They do everything they possibly can to get the consumer what they want, because that's what the consumer pays money for, right? So if there's people holding out fucking literally trillions of dollars, right, over the course of decades, probably, I don't know how much people spend on food. It's definitely in the billions. It might be in the trillions per year. Holding out these wads of cash and being like, we're going to offer to the highest bidder of food that tastes the best and is also the cheapest. Like, man, capitalism's going to fucking find a way to make that happen, subsidies or not. Like, yeah, a cheeseburger might be sort of $5 now. Without subsidies, maybe it would be $6. But then after like 10 years of adjustment, you know, inflation aside, it'd probably go back down to $5 or even go down to $4, you know, like the kind of shit that you can get now for value is incredible. So at the end of the day, if people still want super hyper palatable, super tasty foods, like no one's shoving fucking soybeans and corn down your throat. You don't walk into a store and you're like, man, this is so cheap. I've got to buy these potato chips. I can't afford not to buy them. That doesn't make any fucking sense. Like if they were selling pieces of shit for free, would you buy pieces of shit? I hope not. Like, well, I mean, they're there, you know, you can use them for all kinds of things. No, right? Fundamentally, like we still fucking want potato chips. We want them a lot. And as a country, I hate to use terms like this, but on average, we don't give a fuck about how overweight or out of shape we are. And we start giving a fuck about that at least a little bit. And then we start sort of making better choices and better choices, man, just in all of life. And like one of the things I say every now and again when I talk to folks about nutrition is I just use the term like try to be an adult about things. Like children want whatever the fuck they want. They don't give a fuck. Consequences, like that part of the brain isn't even developed yet. But adults like have to make some tough choices. Like, do you always want to go to work? I don't always want to go to work. Do you always want to brush your teeth? Because there are a person out there that loves to brush their teeth who's not like, you know, completely insane. Like if someone was like, I love brushing my teeth, they'd be like, you need to be fucking admitted because holy fuck, right. What is wrong with you, right? But you do it because you know that if you don't brush your teeth, they're going to fucking rot and all this bad stuff. And people are going to stop talking to you if you have bad breath, so on and so on and so on. So in just the same way, it's tempting to kind of just eat whatever the fuck you want. But at the end of the day, you know, it's on you to make sure that you make the right choices, which might not always feel amazing at the time, but not everything feels amazing at the time. It's literally what being an adult is all about, is delaying gratification, doing the right thing versus doing the tempting thing.
Yeah. It's tempting to do that. And then it's tempting to pick some object to blame and
That's so easy.
And create a team or some kind of a tribe based around the idea that that object is evil or bad, or the consumption of that object is evil or bad, when it's just, if you prefer eating only meat, fine, eat only meat. But I think telling people that it's a healthier way to live than any other way is a little silly. And if you don't like to kill animals or consume them, that's fine too. And you can be very healthy doing that. But to say that beyond those parameters, that it's like the ne plus ultra kind of like health thing, it's like, well, my blood work is pretty damn clean right now.
That's really good, man.
You know? Yeah.
Can I ask you how old you are?
43.
Holy shit.
How old are you?
Don't worry about it, bro. I don't tell things. I'm 35. But like, well, so I'll tell you this, man. Like, as heavy as you have been, first of all, it's really awesome that you're at a healthy body weight this late in the game, so to speak. And second of all, it's really awesome that your blood work is good. And third of all, like, I don't know how you did it. Maybe you could tell me on air. Like, by not staying at 5:30 or whatever, you dodged like a fucking giant bullet. Cause I don't know if you're familiar with the statistics on folks over 400, 500, and 600 pounds respectively, as far as longevity is concerned, but it's like, it's unimaginably bad.
No, I am aware of all of that. And to be honest with you, I wasn't even thinking, it wasn't even a health concern necessarily. I mean, that was a kind of a secondary concern, but it was really, you know, I think when I look at my long-term motivation, I was with a girl who, in a relationship that I actually really cared about, like the first relationship that I wanted to improve. And there was a whole lot of things that she was interested in doing that I just wasn't really physically capable of doing, like hikes or spending a day at a museum, like those kind of things. I just couldn't do that.
Right.
And so,
I was going to make a really crude sex joke, but I'll just shut up.
Yeah. I mean, that seemed to work. It's certainly improved dramatically, but
sure.
But there was that too, but that wasn't the main focus. It was mostly
right.
She wants to go. I remember she was like, come to Paris with me. And I'd been there, but I remembered like, Jesus, just on my own, it was a lot of walking. She's going to be walking around all day. And now when we go, we clock around 10 miles a day. There was no way at 500 plus pounds that I was going to do that. It just was not going to happen.
How was flying at that body weight?
Brutal. If a studio flew me, they would fly me first class, which was about what it's like now to fly coach.
holy shit.
Yeah, it was not fun. And I still need a seatbelt extension. And yeah, it was completely miserable. But so the idea of like, oh, I have this thing. The only way I can improve it right now is by getting healthier and losing weight and being more fit. And so that kind of has just been my long-term motivation. Also, all those things, I had not considered them things that I wanted for myself, and they really were. And so the more I was able to do them, the more I wanted to keep doing them. That's really
awesome.
Yeah, that's been the main thing. But I did spend 17 years plus all the years of being a kid where, you know, we would have a whole, like my mom would go, well, we just consume whole grains now, or we don't consume, you know, I went through all those stages because we lived in Los Angeles. I just wasn't really aware of it. It was just suddenly now all our food is from this little granola hippie store and we're shopping at the bulk bin for stuff. I don't know if that's a thing that everybody's aware of. It was like, you know, it was like the first time you saw organics 35 years ago. And so I went through all of that where my mom was searching for the magical thing that was poisoning me without even really telling me she was doing that. And then when I first started dieting, and for a lot of years, I too was searching for, basically somebody would come to me and say, lectins are bad. And okay, so I don't eat lectins anymore. That's it. Let me read this book about lectins. And I would notice no perceivable difference. And so the next time the new thing would come along, I'd do that. And again, no perceivable difference. As long as I was in a caloric deficit, I was losing weight. And I do think if your preference leads you away from lectins, do the no lectin diet, you know, and that's fine. But
if you can detect them.
Right, exactly. Whatever it is, I think any of these diets are fine. But if you fail at it because you've decided that this is the magical diet, that's where it can be a problem. That's where I think diets can be a problem, because at the end of the day, there's no magic to it, you know?
Yeah. It's really fascinating to me that you were essentially having fad diets done to you before you were aware of fad diets. And also, if I may, can I ask you a little bit about like what it was like to have a diet thrust upon you as a kid? Cause like, I never so much had, like, I grew up in Russia for the first 7 years. So like, we just ate as much food as we could, cause there wasn't a ton of fucking food around.
Right.
But like, did you like, I don't know, I don't want to ask anything super personal that you don't want to answer, but like, did you feel like your parents were restricting you or other family members? Like, was it an understanding that like, well, you were too fat and you had to, something was wrong and you had to do something to change it, or you know what I mean? Like, was that a ever present thing?
When I was five, my grandparents put me on a diet because I was too fat. Now, when I look at pictures of myself at five, I see a totally normal kid. But I went to visit them and they put me on a diet where it was like, we're going to give you smaller portions. You're not allowed to eat any more than this. And so at that point I started sneaking food. I'm aware of my parents, looking for fad diets, but it was done in a different way where it was just like, my mom would discover that the whole family has candida or something like that.
Right.
And so now we're all just going to eat this way. And I would get the feeling that it was really me that was the impetus for this, that if I wasn't showing signs of being on my way to being morbidly obese, that we wouldn't be doing that. But so it wasn't vocalized to me by my parents in that way. There was one point where my father said, if you get to be 200 pounds, I'm putting you on a diet. And at 10, I was 200 pounds and I was put on OptiFast. And I actually didn't hate it. I was enjoying it. And I think I did it for like 2 weeks and was like, hey, I'm actually losing weight. And then I don't know the intricacies of what happened, but my mom, I think, was like, oh, this is unhealthy for a child. We're not doing this anymore. And so we went off that and we went on, you know, the organic ground turkey burger diet or whatever it was at the time that she discovered you know, but I mean, I did the Beverly Hills diet, which is like, I think predominantly pineapple. I did every diet. But
everyone knows pineapple is the secret to weight loss.
Right. I think it's like 4 days of pineapple and then you get papaya too.
Oh my God.
Yeah. All I have is my perspective. It was just very prevalent. If you're going to do a diet, you got to figure out what food is poisoning you and just get rid of that. And that was kind of something we followed. And I saw nutritionists, and different nutritionists would say, don't eat chicken, eat turkey, because chicken is bad for your blood type.
Oh, God. Are you serious?
Yeah. I've been through every version of that. You know, brown rice is bad. White rice is good. You can have this much. And, you know, cream of wheat is bad. Oatmeal is good. And all of this. Dude, the thing I'm loving right now is, as long as I get my protein, I can do the kind of version of if it fits your macros. Now, I choose to eat what I consider to be clean food, and that is like veggies and whole grains, because I'm a little bit scared of ice cream and stuff like that because I was so big, and I'm also a sober person, so I have a history with drugs, and it is easier for me to just go like, if I don't consume that stuff, it's okay. Now, that doesn't mean I'm an absolutist. There are times where I have that stuff, but I do think about it in different ways than like a quote unquote cheat meal.
Sure. You know, are you familiar with the food palatability reward hypothesis?
No.
That's a meaty fucking bunch of words right there, man. That makes me sound extra fucking smart.
Yeah. That's so, some PhD shit.
Ooh. Yep. There's a stamp right there. So, it basically, I'm going to butcher his name, Stefan Guéné, who's been on the Joe Rogan podcast. And he's a super brilliant guy. He's sort of at the forefront of this. And it basically says something like this, that food that is super, super tasty, if you are in a caloric deficit, especially, or you've lost a lot of weight and you're trying to keep it off and you're at maintenance, food that is super, super tasty, especially in those circumstances, makes you sometimes want to eat more of it. It's essentially, the effect can be summed up as like the, you just can't just have one potato chip sort of thing.
Right.
Because, you know, with most foods, as you eat them, it's a semi-linear thing. Like brown rice, like you have a spoonful, you're like, okay, like, do you want even more? You're like, no, I want marginally less than before the spoonful. Right. And then you had 10 spoonfuls later, like, if I could pay someone to never see brown rice again, that would be for the best, right? But with potato chips, after one, you're like, fuck, I want more. And that limit of when you don't want any more potato chips is just super fucking high. So there's kind of like a recursive effect there, where it's a positive feedback loop. So with your, when you mentioned ice cream and you're going to want to fill your macros with that, food palatability reward hypothesis kind of says, like, and, you know, for some people in some situations may very well apply to you. If you have a little bit of ice cream, you know, enough to fit your macros, it may just make you want more of it,
right?
Which is a huge deal. And we say, like, you know, food's super tasty and they sell it to you because, you know, you're going to eat a lot of it, buy a lot of it. It operates under that mechanism super often, where the food is so good, you want more. And if you eat mostly low processed or unprocessed foods, fruits, veggies, whole grains, lean meats, healthy fats, and those foods tend to be tasty. They're fine, right? Like, you know, salmon, brown rice, couple apple slices, and broccoli is not fucking poison. And you're not like, right? Like, it's fine. It tastes good. But you reach your limit of eating that kind of food relatively in alignment with your hunger. So like, as soon as you're not hungry, you're like, you know, you're not like, man, what I fucking kill for now is just a snack on pieces of salmon. Like, what the fuck? Like, okay. Right. People just don't normally say that sort of thing. But if you have this hyper palatable food, it can turn into a kind of a positive feedback loop where you eat more and more and more of it. And that's a big deal. So there's nothing wrong with staying away from those kinds of foods, at least much of the time, sometimes all the time, or most of the time, because you know that if you have those foods, it's not like, I hear you on the being scared of like, fuck, I'm just going to eat ice cream and I'll fall off a fucking wagon. I'm going to eat 10 gallons of ice cream. I'm just going to be super fucking fat and miserable again. My family's going to leave me. Those thoughts, I totally recognize them. They're all wildly irrational, completely ridiculous thoughts.
Right.
You know, like, I've had those thoughts for sure in various other contexts. And, you know, that doesn't make any fucking sense. But it does make sense that if you have a cone, like an ice cream cone within your, instead of brown rice, you could have two or three more ice cream cones, or even if you just let your willpower kick in. It's just tough to like have something that makes you want to eat more of something, and then you're all of a sudden like supposed to use your willpower to not eat it. Like, fuck that. It makes your meal uncomfortable. Someone's like, did you enjoy your ice cream? You're like, no, to be honest, I wish I never fucking had any, because now I just want more of it. Like, if I could just stick to my usual whole foods, I like them enough to eat them. And then I don't just want to eat them anymore after that. And that's super great. So there is absolutely, like, some people say, like, well, you should be having a little bit of a cookie here and there, a little bit of ice cream. If that's up your alley and it doesn't make you want more of it, then that's totally fine. But if you have experimented with this and you know that, like, one cookie, if it doesn't lead to 80 more cookies, makes you feel like you want 80 more cookies, maybe you're just better off eating fewer fucking cookies, and there's not a damn thing wrong with that.
Yeah, this is a great scientific hypothesis that completely mirrors what I've been trying to do, which is the less I can be entertained by my food, and the more I can truly consider food a source of fuel with a functional component to it, the better I am, the safer I am, the more successful I am with this goal. And that's a beautiful hypothesis, which I can totally say is true for me.
Yeah, it's a real kicker. And, you know, people will fall on various parts of the spectrum there, where, like, some people, and I'm sure you know people like this, they just don't have that response to foods, and they just, their baseline levels of hunger and cravings are so low, or they filled so fast, it's just not an issue for them. Like, some people will have like half a plate of brownies, and you're like, oh my God, here we fucking go, right? This is the beginning of a binge. And they'll be like, oh my God, I can't eat anymore. And then they straight up won't eat for 16 fucking hours. And you're like, right. What the fuck? Right? How is that possible? Some other people will have half a brownie after lunch and be like, oh, that's good. I love it. And you're like, you don't want more brownie? And they're like, no, I'm full. And you're like, okay. But other people, and there's everyone in between. And at the other end of the spectrum, you have people that if they sniff brownies, they're straight up stabbing a motherfucker in the throat for them shits. They're going to eat as many as possible until the police put them down,
yeah,
you know, in front of the brownie machine. And if you know you're more like one of those people than the other, you can choose your foods a bit more wisely. And I think there's sort of in the if it fits your macros movement, sometimes there's a sort of false notion of like balance means that you eat dessert and you don't shy away from it. You should definitely not shy away from it out of fear, not of being like, it's bad. Brownies are bad. They're poison. They're the fucking MSG that we've been looking for. That's not true. But if you just know that if once you have a brownie or whatever, that, you know, you're just going to be, there are a lot of cravings you don't want to deal with, or you're going to falter and start eating your own fingers or whatever, then maybe just don't eat so many brownies. And recognizing that, I think, was a huge leap for the scientific community. It probably happened about 5 or 10 years ago. It's filtering down a little bit into everyday practice, but hey, for the love of God, not enough, I guess, because Hollywood sure as hell hasn't caught on to it.
No, we are still out here chasing lectins and gluten and polysaturated fat or mono, whatever this bad saturated fat is. We're chasing all these things. We're chasing egg yolks. I'm sure they're going to be bad again. By the way, I didn't say this, but I wanted to. I wonder if this carnivore movement, and I know it was kind of percolating prior to this movie, but I wonder if this is just a direct FU to the Netflix documentary Game Changers. I wonder if they were like, if a bunch of people were just like, we'll show you, all we're going to eat is meat.
Yeah, that would be hilarious. You know what? There was another documentary that came out before. There's basically a documentary a year now, the food documentary. What the fuck was it called? Remember that shit? It was called What the Health?
Yes. Yes.
I mean, like, I'm pretty sure that was a vegan documentary too, right? I'm quite certain of it.
They haven't done the meat documentary. There hasn't been like the guy.
There hasn't been a meat documentary yet. But I think that What the Health was like a year ago. And I think the carnivore diet really like sort of started ballooning after that.
Right.
I one big boost to the carnivore diet, my understanding is Jordan Peterson. Are you familiar with who that is?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, he started doing it, and every time that he is like asked about it, he's like, first of all, I'm not a nutritionist, so I don't know. Second of all, it like worked for my daughter and for me because we have some weird autoimmune thing, and it's not something I'd recommend to anyone else because it's miserable and it makes traveling like awful and I hate it.
Right.
And then, of course, like since he is like basically a celebrity, a bunch of people don't hear that last part and they're like, "Yeah,
I'm
carnivore diet
too. Yeah.
is going to make me more moral or whatever Jordan Peterson says." And then all of a sudden, you got like tons of people doing it, and I mean that's how fads sort of operate. But I'll tell you what, man. To your point, extremist documentaries don't help any case.
Right.
Like an extremist vegan documentary does probably two things. One, it makes a bunch of people vegan for the wrong fucking reasons, like thinking that's going to save their health or save the planet, where it's really just a nice thing to do for animals, which has its own, you know, tons of value to it. But, you know, people think like, "Oh, I'm going to go vegan. I'm just going to be in super fucking great shape," which is bullshit. And then they fail at another fad diet. And then what it does also is it pushes people in the other direction reflexively, like you say, with the carnivore thing. It's like a giant fuck you to vegans. And all I want to see, Ethan, out of this whole thing, this, I'm telling you, here's my pitch: a fucking dating show where we set up people on a dinner date who have mutually, not different, antagonistic diets.
Yes.
Motherfuckers that straight hate each other. Like carnivore and vegan is the first and I guess only episode, but that's the only episode I want to see, goddammit.
I want to see it too. God, that would be so good. Just the awkward first date.
Now here's where the Hollywood shit comes in. The menu is exclusively things that don't belong to either diet. So it's animal food, but not meat. It's like some kind of processed bullshit that's neither raw meat or whatever fucking carnivores eat, nor is it vegan. Right. Oh my God, the hilarity ensues. Yes, amazing.
Neither one of them can eat, and they have to eat there.
Must eat. Otherwise, they lose $1,000. I don't know. Or like Japanese game show, they lose their lives.
This would be amazing. I'm going to go pitch this show. If we get the show together, you're a producer.
Great.
Dr. Israetel, thank you so much for joining us. I hope to talk to you again in the future. This was fantastic. I really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for submitting questions to AmericanGlutton.net. Rich says, "Food is an addiction for me, and I never seem to stick to a routine for more than a month without falling off the wagon. How did you get yourself over that mental hurdle and the addiction to food and finally make the commitment to stay healthy?" That's a great question, Rich. Thank you. I found that any path I start down that I go off of becomes an incredibly hard path to continue down. So I got really honest with myself and I figured out what I was really capable of doing. And I tried to build in, I wouldn't call them breaks, but I would say deviations that I would consider still a part of the path. So I'm not making an agreement with myself to do something and then breaking that agreement with myself. I'm being honest about what my capabilities are, building into it maybe days or meals that don't or wouldn't necessarily conform to the diet I'm doing. And within those new boundaries, I do not deviate. So I would say set realistic barriers for yourself and then do not break them. But you have to be totally honest with what you're capable of doing. That's my suggestion for you, Rich. Thanks for writing into AmericanGlutton.net. If you have questions you'd like me to answer on the podcast, you can submit them to AmericanGlutton.net.
Thanks for listening to this episode of American Glutton. I'm Ethan Suplee, and as always, joined by my chaperone, Paige Dorian. Follow us on Instagram at American Glutton Podcast. Sincerely.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.